This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Football on the BBC World Service. I'm Manny Jasmi. Coming up, the English Premier League prepares for kickoff. It's the richest league on the planet, but is it the best?
The Premier League is almost like playing rugby with your feet. If you are a really good football team, you have a very big chance against Premier League clubs because Premier League clubs are big, fast and strong, but from a football perspective, they are not really good.
We hear from the man who left Iran as a small boy and didn't return till his debut for the national team 20 years later.
We played against South Korea and we beat them in Tehran in front of more than 100,000 people in the stadium. And I can't explain it in words for you, but it was a great feeling, great moment to be back like that and to see all those people who were happy for us that we won. And I will always cherish that moment.
And we remember a forgotten hero from football's past.
Ottaway was one of the trailblazers, I think. I mean, we're talking about a period in the 1860s and 1870s. I mean, who could ever dream of achieving what he achieved as a sportsman? Something like that could never happen today.
But first, the Dutch coach Raymond Verheyen has told World Football that the arrival of more foreign coaches into the English Premier League will eventually help to improve the national team, which he currently says is a joke. Verheyen, who's been a member of the coaching staffs of South Korea, the Netherlands and Russia at three World Cups, has also worked at three European Championships, as well as clubs like Manchester City, Chelsea and Barcelona. He says the physicality of English football makes it like playing rugby with your feet, and English players struggle when they go to play in other countries because they have to think about football things. He's also told this programme that the Welsh winger Gareth Bale, with whom he worked while Verheyen was the Wales assistant coach, should leave Tottenham Hotspur for Real Madrid.
Yeah, I think he should move, of course, because the Premier League is the biggest league in the world in terms of money, but it is not the biggest league in the world in terms of football. And if he wants to develop himself further as a football player, it's much better to play in Spain. First of all, because the quality of football in Spain is much higher than in England. And also, he has a much bigger chance of playing Champions League football, quarterfinal, semifinal, final, against the biggest teams in Europe. So for his personal football development, it would be very good to move outside the Premier League.
Is he good enough to make a serious impact, though, at the Bernabeu?
Easily.
What about the new coaches who have come into the Premier League this season, people like Manuel Pellegrini? How long will it take them to adjust to the way that the football is played here and maybe to adjust their coaching methods? Or do you think that football should adjust to them in England?
I would choose the last one. Because what you see in the Premier League is that there is this tendency of more and more physical game. The Premier League is almost like playing rugby with your feet. Bigger players, stronger players, faster players. But there is hardly any development in football. The level of football is relatively poor in the Premier League. And that is why it was, almost easy for Ajax Amsterdam last year with their very young team to outplay Manchester City because the level of football of Ajax is extremely high. If you are a really good football team, you have a very big chance against Premier League clubs because Premier League clubs are big, fast and strong, but from a football perspective, they are not really good.
So do you think it's easier for non-English coaches to come and work in England than it is for English coaches to go and work abroad?
Of course. Yeah, of course. I mean, who is the last English manager who has been successful abroad? I mean, that is already a signal in itself. And it's the same with English players abroad. How many English players have been successful abroad? Because once they go abroad, football things are demanded. So what I hope is that these foreign managers, when they step into the Premier League, that they can raise that they can raise the level of football. And then hopefully also the English national team will finally be successful, because the English national team is an absolute joke. I'm from a Mickey Mouse country, Holland, with very small country with a very small population. But we always hope that we play against British teams, because even with our club teams like Ajax, PSV, you know that you have a bigger chance against an English team than against a German or a Spanish team.
Finally, Raymond, what did you make of the Manchester United manager David Moyes' admission that he overtrained Robin van Persie when they were in Australia so that van Persie could catch up with the fitness of the other players because he'd been away for a bit longer?
Yeah, that is very traditional thinking. First of all, he had to travel for 24 hours to Australia. Secondly, he is jet-lagged. Thirdly, he is less fit than his teammates. Those are three very important reasons to be careful with him. Yeah, it was just a matter of time before Robin would pick up some little niggle. I can't give you a better example of amateurism.
That's the Dutch coach Raymond Verheyen, as outspoken as ever. Well, from pre-season football to the action itself, which kicks off in the English Premier League and Spain on Saturday. As well as the new signings on the pitch, the Premier League also has a new club owner to welcome. The billionaire Shahid Khan became the sixth American to own a Premier League club when he bought Fulham from Mohamed Al-Fayed last month. Khan, who also owns the Jacksonville Jaguars American football team, has made his money in car manufacturing and is amongst the top 200 richest men in the world. I've been speaking to him about his plans for Fulham, his notable moustache, and how risky his purchase of a football club may be.
I think anything in life has a risk. Obviously, you have a reward. Premier League has a lot in common with the NFL. The key difference, obviously, is the risk of relegation. You know, you have to, from a business aspect, you've got to be able to, understand that and, be able to have a plan, to get over that. There's a huge amount of commonality with the NFL. The greatest emotional experiences you're going to have, highs and lows, are going to be in the sport.
Another difference between the Premier League and the NFL is the concept of franchises. Clubs or franchises, as they're known in America, are moved from city to city. That's not something that's really ever been much of an attraction in British sport. But given the crowded market in London, I mean, six clubs alone from London are in the Premier League. Can you see it as being a sensible move to perhaps move Fulham to a less crowded environment?
I personally don't see that. I think Fulham is Fulham for what it is, which is West London. Six teams from London are in Premier League because they've had a fan base which has given them the resources to compete at the highest level. I mean, they're there because of the merits. I mean, they're six of the 20 best clubs in football.
Shahid, I must tell you that I'm a blind person, so I don't actually know what you look like, but I've been told that you have an extremely flamboyant moustache.
Well, flamboyancy is in the eye of the beholder, okay? So.
But if the beholder can't see you, describe it for me.
Have them describe it for you.
How do you maintain it?
I don't. It's just like a gift from God. I do nothing.
I used to have quite a big moustache, but it was really annoying, especially when I was having a drink. Bits of it would sort of float around in the drink. Don't you ever fancy maybe trimming it slightly?
Well, it's whatever God gives you, I think. My dad had a moustache, my grandfather had a moustache, so I come from a long list of moustaches.
That's the Fulham owner Shahid Khan discussing some of the very hottest topics in Football With Me. Well, Fulham Swiss international defender Philippe Senderos is no doubt still basking in the glow of his nation's 1-0 win over Brazil on Wednesday. Switzerland are currently 4 points clear at the top of their World Cup qualifying group with 4 games to play. So it's looking good for Senderos and co. to maybe face Brazil again, this time in the World Cup.
I think we shouldn't think about Brazil just yet. There's still 4 games to go, and we know the 4 games that we have are tough games. And until you're mathematically in Brazil, you know, you shouldn't. You should just be dreaming, and it should be your ambition. But you should concentrate on the games that you have to play.
And of course, you know, you have a history as a national team. I mean, in the last World Cup, you beat Spain. I mean, that must have been probably the highlight, would you say, for the national team of recent years?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, we didn't go through in that group, but to beat Spain, the world champion, was definitely a highlight. To qualify for such a small country, to qualify for the last 2 World Cups, it's been a great achievement, and hopefully we can do that for Brazil as well. Of course, you know, we continue to bring players out and to play abroad, and that's very important, and our league is pretty strong. We see the Swiss teams doing well in the European competitions, and that's very important for the national team as well.
I mean, I've followed your career since Arsenal, and you're only 28 years old, and it looks like you've been playing for like so many years, and now here you are with Fulham. How are things going there for you? Because there's been this dramatic change of ownership, if you like, and you know, Mr. Al-Fayed has finally moved on. So do you notice anything changing in the club with this handover?
Not just yet. I think for the moment, the current president, the new president, has kept the things the same as before, and I think in the current climate is the right thing to do, and the team is doing well, so hopefully we can start the season well. On my side, well, I'll hope to play this season a lot, so I can prepare the World Cup in the best conditions.
And of course, when we look at Fulham, we look at them as a very stable club. You never think of Fulham going down, but then you don't see Fulham pushing, you know, for those European places. Do you feel that now with this change, that it's time to go up to that next level?
I don't know if the change will do much, but certainly with the quality players that we have in this squad, we should be doing better, and hopefully everyone has that ambition, and we can push on for hopefully, you know, just be shy of the European places, but we should be battling for that.
And this is an interesting season we have in England, because obviously there's been change at Manchester United, Manchester City, Chelsea. Do you sort of begin to think we have no idea who can win the league, or do you think it's still same old, same old?
I think the top four have been pretty stable the last few years, and I think even if they've had few changes, they will continue being up there. Spurs are also getting stronger, and I think Liverpool as well. It's a very tough league, you know, we all know that. But definitely the Manchester clubs are up there. I hope Arsenal do well as well.
The Fulham defender Philippe Senderos with World Football's Ashish Sharma, and Fulham begin their season away to Sunderland. You're listening to World Football on BBC World Service with me, Manny Jasmi. So, fewer than 300 days to go till the World Cup. In fact, to be absolutely precise, it's 299. Japan, South Korea, Australia and Iran have already joined the hosts, Brazil. For the Iranians, it will be their 4th appearance in the tournament. Carlos Queiroz's side put together a winning run of 3 consecutive victories to finish top of their group, led by the goals of the Standard Liège striker and accomplished violinist Reza Qutbanejad. He emigrated from Iran to Holland with his family when he was a small boy in the early 1990s. The next time he stepped on Iranian soil was last October as a 24-year-old to make his debut for the national team. Qutbanejad had an incredible 2 years. After scoring freely for Sint-Truiden in the lower reaches of the Belgian top division, he was signed by the country's most successful club and selected for Iran. Despite representing Holland in every age group below the national team, he accepted. Since then, he's scored 5 times in 7 matches, including the goal that sealed Iran's place in Brazil. He's been telling me about the humble beginnings from which Iran's newest football hero has come.
I was young, I think I was 4 or 5 when we left and we came to Europe, to the Netherlands. I came with my parents and my brother. My parents wanted a good life for me, to have good possibilities and great options for my career. So I think that's why they did it, for me and my brother. We owned a restaurant, and my parents worked so hard for us, for me and my brother, to be here where we are today. And I'm just grateful that they did so much for me and my brother, actually.
Am I right in thinking that when you returned to Iran to play for the national team, that was the first time you'd returned to the country since you left?
Yes, it's true. I didn't know what to expect, and it was wonderful. We played against South Korea and we beat them in Tehran in front of more than 100,000 people in the stadium. And it was a really crucial game for us because we had to win to be in the race for the World Cup, and we won 1-0. So it was a great feeling, great moment to be back like that, and to see all those people who were happy for us that we won. And me, I was also very lucky at that moment, and I will, like I said, I will always cherish that moment because it was really wonderful.
And then you scored goal after goal after goal, and you scored the goal that took Iran to the World Cup, again against South Korea. Can you explain what it feels like to know that you're the man who scored the goal that took your country to the World Cup?
All the guys, not only me, we did such a great job, actually, something that nobody believed in from the beginning. Everybody thought, okay, it's Iran, you know, if they're going to go to the playoffs or they're gonna not going to make it. And we proved everybody wrong, and it's so sweet when you, after hard working, you get a prize, like qualifying for Brazil, for example.
When did it sink in?
Yeah, well, when did it sink in? You know, actually, we were really happy after the game when we were in South Korea still. But I must say, when we came in Iran, it finally got through to us, like, wow, we did some good things. Because when we came on the airport, it was crazy. People were singing, crying, laughing. Everybody was so happy, and it was unbelievable. I cannot explain how big it was for the people, not only in Iran, but all the Iranians all over the world. They were so happy, and we are so proud that we have given that to them.
Who would you like to play in the group?
It doesn't matter, you know. Actually, it does matter, because you want to leave the better opponents out of your group, but it's not up to us. We just have to go there. We know that we are not the strongest team, but you know, in World Cup, you have only strong teams because everybody, the best 32 countries in the world, qualify there. So we're just going to go there, and we try to do our best, and we try to give these 3 games, we try to give everything we have. And after this, we can look back and say, okay, it was good or it was bad. But we're going to give 100%, and we're going to see after the World Cup.
It's very interesting that you say that, because there are some players who would say, oh, I want to play Argentina, I want to be on the same pitch as Messi, or I want to play in Brazil because they've got Neymar. But you're thinking maybe of getting beyond the group stage and going further.
For me, it doesn't matter if you play against Argentina, Brazil, or, yeah, you know, on paper, and when you put the names on the paper, yeah, it's nice to see that. But for us, the most important thing is not to go there to play 3 games and have a holiday and come back. At least this is how I think about it, you know, and I'm sure that the other players think also like this, because for me, it's important to go there and show our skills and show what we're worth and show that we are not just a small country, a small name, and that we made it luckily to Brazil. We have to go there and try our best to come to the next round, and you have to have ambitions. So it's maybe people are going to say, okay, this guy is crazy, but you have to have ambitions, and we are going there to try to achieve something, and everything is possible in football, so why not? I'm really confident that it's going to be okay.
The Iran striker, Reza Qutshan-Nejad. Finally, the international season in Europe kicked off this week with a raft of friendlies, which included the oldest fixture in the world.
The teams came out together, England in white shirts. The King, the Queen and Princess Elizabeth headed the distinguished names that were here to watch, and the King shook hands with the teams, first with the Scottish visitors, and then with England, the latter being conveniently marked with numbers. During the interval, we were reminded that there's a war on by a tough commando display. It isn't everyone who can stand being stripped to the waist when there's an icy wind in the Straits of Dover.
England and Scotland first played each other 141 years ago in 1872 when they drew 0-0. England's captain that day, their first of an illustrious line of men, was Cuthbert Ottaway. He's since been succeeded by the likes of Bobby Moore, Brian Robson, David Beckham and currently Steven Gerrard.
I have to admit it was only recently I was aware of him that he was the first captain and the first England captain to play against Scotland as well, so he's certainly a name I'll never forget now after learning about him.
Yeah, as England captain, you know, you're aware of the history of what's gone before.
Yeah, of course, that's important. England's got a wonderful history, had top players for many, many years, and, you know, as a player, you're learning all the time about what's gone on before. Obviously, it was a long, long time ago. But, yeah, I mean, that the first guy to ever lead his country out, I mean, that's certainly obviously very proud for his family.
And it was the 1800s, but I believe he played at the top level, I think five different other sports. I mean, can you imagine the scenario whereby, you know, you'd be playing at Wimbledon and then playing in a test match and captaining England at football?
That's unbelievable to think that he had that much quality, really, if you like. But it goes to show he was a terrific sportsman and loved his sport. And I think to get to the top and play for England's unbelievable, and to lead them out, there's no special feeling.
As the current England captain, Steven Gerrard, with John Murray. As well as captaining England's brand new football team, Cuthbert Ottaway also played the equivalent of Test cricket and won the prestigious honour of an Oxford University Blue in three other sports. But until this week, when a headstone for his grave was unveiled in London, his story had largely been forgotten.
Today we come together to remember before God our brother Cuthbert Ottaway, to give thanks for his life and for his contribution to the supporting life of this nation. We remember not only his achievements as a representative footballer, but also as a national cricketer, racket player, sprinter, barrister, and family man. We honour him as an all-round achiever who might inspire us all to live out our full potential.
I'm Paul Mackay, I'm an England fan, supporter, and I'm the organiser of the Cuthbert Ottaway Memorial Fund. And as part of that, I've actually fundraised £2,500 just to actually replace the neglected memorial that was previously on Cuthbert's grave. I think, to be honest, most people, if you ask most people who Cuthbert Ottaway is, you look with a blank expression. I don't think he's received the recognition that he rightly deserves. I think that you walk round Wembley and there isn't anything to say that Cuthbert Ottaway was England's first football captain, and I think that's a real shame.
God, whose son Jesus Christ was laid in the tomb, bless, we pray, this grave and memorial as a place where the body of Cuthbert Ottaway, your servant, may rest in peace.
Mick Southwick is the author of Ottaway's biography called England's First Football Captain. He believes the FA should do more to recognise Ottaway's career.
Well, as unrecognised as he is, I think being England's first football captain is something that obviously will never be done again. It's one of those historical achievements that can't be equaled or bettered. There has to be, surely, a recognition of this from from the football fraternity.
How did he compare to the other great all-rounders of his day?
Ottaway was one of the trailblazers, I think. I mean, we're talking about a period in the 1860s and 1870s where organised sport was just taking root. There wasn't even a hint of professionalism. So it was an unspoilt era. And, it must have set a trail, certainly. But there were many others like Ottaway, but he was the best of his day. Through my research, I think there's no doubt about that.
Why did he only play twice for England?
Well, of course, he died aged 27. He played the 72 match against Scotland and the 74 match against Scotland, both as captain. Recent research suggests that he should have been captain in the match in between, in 73, but for some reason he was forced to withdraw. In the FA Cup final of 75, he picked up a career-ending injury. So he didn't play football after 75. So circumstances, I suppose, there's only one match a year. So he played in two of the first three, and then injury interrupted his career.
And as his biographer, you probably know him better than anyone alive today. When you read about people extensively, you get to know them through the pages, don't you? So how do you feel about him?
Like many cricket and football fans, envious to have achieved so much in so short a time. I mean, who could ever dream of achieving what he achieved as a sportsman at Eton, Oxford, in the national games, playing alongside W.G. Grace at cricket, scoring centuries, first-class centuries. I mean, it's almost something like that could never happen today. So envious, admiration, of course, yes, all these things. A spectacularly short career.
And he died after catching a chill following a night's dancing, I understand. So footballers, even in those days, were getting into trouble from going out on a night.
So it seems. I haven't got any other detail about that night. He was newly married, pregnant wife at the time. Who knows how it happened? There's very little information, even about how he died. We suspect pneumonia. His family had a history of diabetes. That may have something to do with it. But pneumonia officially is how he died. So, all very tragic.
That's Mick Southwick, who's written the biography of England's first ever football captain and a genuine sporting all-rounder, Cuthbert Ottaway. And that's all for this week. Remember, if you want to download World Football, just go to our website at bbcworldservice.com/worldfootball. And you can follow us on Twitter at WSWorldFootball. Join us again at the same time next week. Until then, always remember, World Service, World Football.